Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. On this episode of the podcast, I'm excited to share my recent conversation with Jonathan Bassel. Jonathan is a graduate in our Executive MBA class of 2018. He is also part of the leadership team at Toast, a software company focused on the restaurant industry. Jonathan and I recently connected via Zoom to talk more about his story, how he decided to pursue an MBA, what led him to Darden, the work he's been doing at Toast, and so much more. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. So without further ado, here's my interview with Jonathan Bassel. Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Brett, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. I have to tell our listeners the inspiration for this conversation. First of all, you're an interesting person. You know, we featured you on the blog, wanted to get you on the podcast for a while, and then I got an email from you, and you were ringing the bell at the New York Stock Exchange. Is that right? Did I get that right?
I was actually fist pumping from the New York Stock Exchange while we were ringing the bell. I want to make that very clear. Work for Toast, which is one of the fastest growing software, vertical software businesses ever. I think we were one of the fastest to 100 million in ARR and had the good fortune of joining early. In fact, joined Toast while I was still enrolled at Darden and negotiated my deal with Toast in between classes. I remember that in Saunders Hall. And, we've had a great run. It's full of ups and downs, certainly, but had the opportunity to ring the bell at the New York Stock Exchange on September 22nd and had to make sure I fist pumped for added, interest. But a great experience, one that certainly will likely not happen for me again. And a great kind of culmination of a lot of different things.
Can I ask you what that experience is like? Because, I mean, I don't foresee that being part of my journey. And I'm sure some of our listeners, maybe you've seen other companies do it when they've gone public and they're standing up there. What's it like to be part of a company that's there ringing the bell? It's obviously a huge day for the company.
It is. When I was growing up, I wanted to be a professional athlete. And I wanted to be a professional athlete because, you want to be competitive and you want to reach the World Series. So for me, I wanted to be a baseball player. Wasn't good enough. And so got into business. But it's what I imagine professional athletes feeling when they make it or they win the Super Bowl, the World Series, whatever. It that's how it felt for me. And not just the actual moment or the celebration, but all of the work that you've done and sacrifices you've made and the ways you've pushed yourself to perform better, all of those things work together to create the moment. Right. And so it's as much about the work that you do and in realizing an outcome that is unique as the actual event. The event was cool. Don't get me wrong. Right. I could tell you stories about little things when you walk up the back hallway, up to the platform, the coolest little thing is they have you sign the wall. So you put your signature on the wall in this back hallway that you walk up into the platform, and you're looking as everyone who's had that experience also signed it. So a lot of little things that were really cool, but the best part is realizing that all the hard work that you put in, has led to this outcome, which was a great feeling.
And I take it when you're there and you're ringing the bell, you have a sense of how it's going to go, or is it, a moment where you're like, all right, once more into the breach, we've been told that this is maybe going to look a certain way and we're waiting for the market to confirm that. What's that like?
It's for us, it was really good. I mean, we opened pricing at $40 a share, and the first trade happened around noon at 63. And to see that, how that kind of came to be was really cool. And to be on the floor for the first trade, which happened several hours after we rang the bell, was really interesting. Just to watch the market makers negotiate and work with different investors and find a price was a really interesting experience. And we actually got to ring a bell for the first trade. But the actual process of going up at 9 o'clock and ringing the bell was just really surreal, to be honest with you. We had about 100 people on the trading floor that were looking up at us, and you know, not certainly an experience that you plan for. And they open these doors, you walk up there, and if you ever watched it on TV, you'll see the company's logo is behind the folks on the platform, the podium. But what happens is that's really just two doors that open. And so they open these doors and you walk out. All of a sudden you see the entire trading floor. You see all the folks in your company. You see, you know, the squawk box down there in studios right in front of the podium. And so you get to see Jim Cramer and all of those folks. And that was all really, really cool, really fast. It happened very quickly. I think we got up there at 8:50 and we rang it at 9. And we're down by 9:05. And then you're kind of like, all right, well, what's next? You know, we got to do the first trade. And then really the next day, I sent out an email to our team where the subject was day one. Cause we're trying to route, like, now it's, we were the highest priced software IPO ever. So the multiple on top of our revenue that we earned was the highest ever. And which is great, but also scary, right? Because you have really high expectations you have to live up to. And so immediately the next day, it was about rallying, you know, our 2,500 employees around, we've got great expectations and we have to deliver. And we've done, and it's been great. It's been great since that day.
It's interesting, that idea about how, you know, that effectively marks time in a way, and now you move forward from that thing, and how do you sort of plot the next course for the business?
Yeah. The analogy we used in our org was, you know, the miracle on ice, right? And how the U.S. beat USSR in the 80 Olympics. But that actually wasn't the gold medal game, right? That was the semifinals. And so they had to go on and beat Finland in the next game. I was a hockey player growing up, played in college. And they actually had to beat Finland to win the gold medal. And there was a chance they wouldn't medal at all had they lost. And so we've used this analogy of, like, don't lose to Finland. Right, we've reached this milestone of taking the company public and achieving great success and great outcomes for everyone, but don't lose to Finland, which the analogy is, like, don't let it go. Like, we got to go through our execution. We have to continue that. And the team has really responded. You know, the team has really responded. And I could talk forever about why that is, but we've got great people and great leadership, and you know, try and keep it very simple for ourselves.
Let's talk a little bit more about you. Tell us your story, and I guess what did you do before you came to Darden?
Yeah, so I've really spent my entire career, you know, leading sales organizations that sell things and services to small businesses. So I really cut my teeth after college. I spent 8 years with a company called Billy Casper Golf, which owned and operated golf courses, and I didn't know it at the time. And it's this my. Like, a lot of my thinking on career development has been shaped by my experience, not clearly, but it was a very small company, but growing incredibly fast. And what that led to was, you know, they offered me opportunities and experiences that other companies would not have, right? Just because they're smaller and they're growing fast. So I was really lucky. I happened to love golf, so that was a plus. But it was really my first introduction to a high growth business where you're you know, 2x-ing the business every year. And so I was there 8 years and really cut my teeth, learned how to run and operate businesses. And then I left and was recruited by a company called Golf Now, which is owned by Comcast. And Golf Now was basically the open table for tee times in the golf space. I spent 4 years there. Again, another high growth business where you're 2x-ing every year. We went from, I don't know, 15, 16 million in revenue. To the time I left, it was north of 150 million. And so again, high growth business, but I started to get into technology and specifically marketplaces, consumer marketplaces, and left Golf Now after four and a half years and joined a company called OrderUp, which was an early stage venture backed startup. We raised $7 million in our Series A from Revolution Ventures, which happens to be out of DC, and it's Steve Case's, you know, kind of early stage venture fund. We raised at the same time as DoorDash, right around the same time. We were based in Baltimore. They're based obviously in Silicon Valley. And that was my first opportunity to kind of grow a team, build an organization from scratch, right? And we were attacking food delivery for restaurants that didn't offer food delivery. It was a really fascinating product. And it was also my first time working for a venture-backed startup and having equity or piece the action, which was important to me. And we were acquired by Groupon about 15 months after we raised our Series A. So now I've got another first. It's kind of my first liquidity event or outcome, which was great. And we went to work for Groupon, acquired us. And then I led, I was a VP of sales at OrderUp, and then led the sales organization for Groupon that sold into restaurants. Was there for about 3 years, and which was another high growth business. And I got a call, ironically, from one of the co-founders at Toast while I was at, this is a really good lesson for anyone out there. I got a call from one of the co-founders at Toast while I was at OrderUp after we had been acquired, but the timing wasn't good because I still had equity that had to be vested, right? And so it wasn't a great time to leave. But I took the call and I acted as if, you know, it was the most important call that I could ever take. That was just my mentality. So I prepared, you know, I was really thought, I learned as much as I could about the business. And somehow I impressed, you know, Aman, who's one of the co-founders at Toast, who's my boss today at Toast, and explained it wasn't the right time. But I suggested someone from my network that I've got someone who you should talk to. And they ended up hiring him. And we kept in touch, you know, for 2 or 3 years, in fact. And in the summer of 17, we caught up again. The timing was better, right? And decided to join Toast. At the time, Toast was in between their Series B and C rounds, so relatively small. And again, it was another opportunity to kind of grow from scratch. The difference this time, the difference from OrderUp was much earlier, right? They had just raised the Series A and were still kind of searching for product market fit, whereas Toast had kind of established that really good list of investors, which is really important. So Bessemer, which is one of the best, if not the best SaaS investor in the world, led their Series B. It was really, I could see it at the time, and we talk about this with our team all the time. It was really a once in a lifetime opportunity because of a number of factors when I looked at it objectively. And I started to learn how to think this way based on my time at Dart, to be honest with you. I was about a year in. And I looked at, number one, the size of the TAM or the total addressable market. Massive, right? 1 million restaurants. In comparison to my time in golf, there are 12,000 golf courses in the US, 15,000 maybe. And there's like 15,000 restaurants in New York City. So a TAM many multiples larger than the golf space. That's good, right? Number two, the unit economics of a deal, of a transaction, was really remarkable at the time because of the revenue model. And so you get a big TAM and you've got a really strong kind of unit economic profile, which is rare. And then three, you had this macro environment where restaurants were beginning to migrate from what we call locally installed systems, right, into the cloud. Many other verticals and spaces had already, you know, made that transition. Restaurants had not, so it was early. We offer a cloud product. And so you put those three things together, right, where you've got a big TAM, really, really attractive unit economics, and a macro tailwind, right, where you knew restaurants were going to, over time, going to have to migrate to cloud products. And it seemed like a no-brainer. And on top of that, really a really remarkable leadership team. And it was really a no-brainer. So I joined in the summer of 17. You know, we were doing around 20 million-ish in revenue. We're many multiples of that today. We've now hired many folks from Darden, right? They're on our short list of when we need great talent. We source out of Darden. And today I run... And I'm really responsible for the core operation of our company, team north of 1,000 people, really great team. And again, even though we're a public company and we've reached scale, it's the TAM has not gone away. It's still massive. I think we've said that we've captured around 8% of our addressable market. And so we're still a high growth business and hope to be one for many years.
So our listeners tuning in on your story and hearing, you know, how your career grew and developed, probably curious, you know, how did you decide you wanted to pursue an MBA? How did you say now is the right time for me to take this?
Yeah, it's interesting because I get this question a lot from folks who were me 5 years ago. And they're like, well, how did you decide to do this, right? Because I had 3 kids, okay, a newborn and 2 young kids. I traveled almost every week for work. I was constantly on the road, had a big team. We were growing rapidly. And, I worked for a guy at OrderUp that was the former CIO at Domino's, and he has an MBA from top program. And I saw how he could connect all of the dots within a business. He could connect finance and accounting to product and engineering to marketing to sales, certainly, and operations. He could connect all these dots, and I couldn't. I could connect my dot. I knew my dot, which was sales. I didn't have to build into sales organization really, really well, but I couldn't connect all of them. And it was very clear to me. And I just started doing some research and stumbled upon Darden. You know, it was based in the Baltimore, D.C. area. And I realized at that point that I had to get an MBA from a top program in order to connect the dots. Okay. And understand all of the underlying reasons for business outcomes, for certain strategic decisions, just required a deeper set of tools and knowledge that I did not have. Okay. His advice to me was to not get it. So I asked him, I said, do you think I should do this? He said, no, you'll learn it while you're here. And I think he was wrong. And I told him that and applied to Darden. And it was one of the best professional decisions I've ever made, because very quickly I started to see, I couldn't connect them right away, but I could start to see other dots. Right. And then finally towards about a year in, I understand all of this. I understand all of this works and how it impacts decisions and, the type of acumen you need to have to grow. Right. And Darden was a remarkable experience. I thought really everything was exceeded my expectations and, really enjoyed my time there. I would tell you, and I tell folks this all the time, folks that ask me about this, there are people who get an MBA to get the piece of paper, to get the job they want, right? Which happens, that definitely happens. That does not make you good at it, right? And you have to be good at it if you want to grow. And that is a fact. And so getting the skills that make you better, infinitely better at what you do, is the most important thing you should think about when pursuing, program, an MBA or a program like Darden. And it's the advice I give people all the time. If you don't think you're going to get better, it's not worth your time. You have to get better. Because it's not the next job, it's the job 3 jobs from now, right? Which is where you really start to thrive.
What led you to say, Darden is the place I'd like to be? Was it mostly geography, proximity? Was there something else?
No, because I was traveling so much that really I didn't have, really wasn't limited geographically. I really thought the case method would be good for me specifically. Certainly the alumni base and the folks that I reached out to, almost everyone responded, even though I wasn't a graduate or even a student. And so it seemed very engaged alumni base. And from some of the visits that I did, I could tell the quality of the instruction was unlike anything I'd ever seen. It was really good. And I would support that with my time there. So it was really all of those factors. Certainly visiting, at the time it was in Charlottesville, and visiting Charlottesville was certainly, a plus, not a negative. It's such a great town. But it was really the quality of the education and the engagement of the alumni base that really kind of made my decision very easy over some other top programs.
Well, let's talk about the past year and a half plus at Toast. Sure, some of our listeners are listening to your story and kind of thinking about, all right, the pandemic disruption, hospitality, restaurant industry. Must have been a pretty wild ride between when you joined the team to, ringing the bell. What happened in between? Not necessarily a linear path.
Yeah, there'll be a book written about it for sure one day, for sure. And so when I joined, again, low 20s in terms of ARR, growing 100% year over year, more than that. We raised, our last private round was raised in February of 2020. So just before the pandemic hit, we raised $500 million at a $5 billion valuation from, I think it may have been Tiger Global. But if you look at our list of investors, it's the who's who, right? It's Tiger Global, it's T. Rowe Price, it's TCV, Lead Edge, Bessemer, some of the best investors in the world. So we raised and we were really excited because we raised $500,000 and only gave up 10% of the business. This is crazy. And then COVID hit, right? And we had seen elements of this in our supply chain. We sourced products from Asia in late 19, early 20, but we weren't sure. We were thinking about it more from a supply chain disruption than a demand disruption. But it became very clear in early to mid-March that it was going to be a real problem. So we went through and kind of modeled a worst case scenario, and which was the prudent thing to do. We had a reduction in force of about 1,500 people, which is about half our company, which was very difficult. And that happened in early April. And so you're going from the high of raising a significant amount of capital, right, at a really high valuation, to trying to preserve that capital in about 45 days. But we knew, right, as long as you, and this is what we told our team, as long as you believe that eating in restaurants is endemic to human behavior, which it has been for many, many years, then eventually the supply of restaurants would always balance with demand. Like it would just always, at some point in time, they would rebalance. And what we started to see, pre-COVID, the amount of restaurant, the percentage of our restaurant sales that came through takeout or delivery or digital channels was probably sub 5%. Okay. And in May, April or May, maybe it was probably May, the percentage of a restaurant sales for Toast customers that came through takeout or delivery was around 80%. And we've seen this, we've seen the acceleration to e-com and digital channels and the digitization of analog businesses. It's been well documented over the last 18 months, but we really started to feel it. And all of a sudden people were buying our product. And we did a lot to help support our customers. We offered, digital software for free. We waived software fees. We did a number of things to support the industry. And that was just the right thing to do. But, that summer, all of a sudden, the restaurant volume started to increase. And we started to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And by early fall, our valuation had actually grown. So despite the reduction in force and despite the impact of the restaurant space, our valuation actually grew by almost 50% by early fall of 20. And then as restrictions began to lift and as folks were able to get back into restaurants, our business took off, faster than we've ever seen. And it's continued that way. A year later, here we are in September of 21, and we're ringing the bell and our growth rate has actually accelerated. And the restaurant industry, while not perfect and still suffering from labor shortages and a number of really difficult challenges. The restaurant scene, you know, restaurants are busy, okay, and they're recovering, and we think we've played a big role in that. You know, I think it's a good lesson, and we always kind of focus on our mission, which is really to help restaurants thrive and do what they love, and that guided every decision that we made. Like, is this good for our customers? Is this good for our customers? You know, is it good? That's how we made our decisions. That's why we gave away products for free. That's why we stopped charging them our SaaS fees, right? We took a significant revenue hit in order to support them. And it was the right thing to do. And I think it's certainly been part of our recovery. But you go from, if you think about the last 18 months, you go from one high of, we just raised a lot of money at a great valuation, to, oh my gosh, this thing's like going to die. Okay. To, wait a minute, they're coming back. Okay, to the highest price software IPO ever. And I think you have to go through that period of real, you know, challenge to earn the right, all right, to have a great outcome. But, you know, these outcomes are not easy. They're very rare, and it's very difficult. And so I think, and we feel like we're prepared for any challenge at this point, because we've already, you know, gone through some really difficult times.
So I have so many questions about what you just shared. I wonder, was there anything in your life that it prepared you for, like, that's a lot of adversity, yeah, like a high to a low to, like, I mean, in 45 days, the whiplash of all of that. Was there anything that you pulled on that helped you through that, or that collectively the team there at Toast?
Yeah, found it's useful? A good question. I will tell you, we laid off a lot of people. And my org in particular was hit pretty hard. The one of the most difficult conversations I had was actually with an MBA summer intern from Darden that had interned with us in the summer of 19, accepted a full-time offer in the fall, and was set to start with us in May 2020. That was the most difficult conversation I had. And he actually now works for us. So by July, we're like, hey, you know, we want you to, and he's doing an amazing job. But I think what we thought about was at its core, it was going to be temporary, right? Like, restaurants are just not going to go away. And actually, if you look at the data, if you look at, you know, we found this graph that showed basically restaurant sales volume by year for the last 30 years. And we looked at, you know, 2007, 2008, we looked at all of the moments, 9/11, all of the moments of great disruption. And really, the delta between, call it the trailing three-year average, and the decline in those periods of time was not significant. It really wasn't. And, like, God, it makes sense, because you have to eat. Like, you just, you know, you have, that's, it's just part of, you know, human behavior. And so we knew, as long as people were going to go out to eat, right? And if you remember, there was a lot of stimulus given out, okay? And so we knew, as long as there was demand to eat in a restaurant, that the supply of restaurants would always balance. So even if half the restaurants in the U.S. closed, as long as the demand returned, another thing we learned, right, at Darden, as long as the demand was there, the restaurants would return, right? Because think about it, if you have half as many restaurants in a market and demand is returned to normal, the restaurants are too busy. And so what do they do? They open more, right? To balance out the supply. And so we knew that deep down, as painful as everything was, we knew that was going to happen. We were very confident in that happening. And that's in fact what has happened. So I don't know if there's anything from my background other than having a deep belief in, you know, macro factors that gave us a lot of confidence. And so certainly was not easy. Trust me, it was not a walk in the park. It was very difficult. But we just kind of day by day, you know, just got through it. And we're certainly rewarded, right, for doing so.
You mentioned the acceleration of the business, you know, come fall or so. You know, you've gone through that sort of the down and then starting to come back up. Do you chalk that up to restaurants acknowledging that their business had fundamentally changed and they needed a different platform, or just, I mean, that's what was happening.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing it everywhere with small businesses diversifying their sales channels from primarily in-store to, I mean, look at Shopify, look at, you know, what they've done over the last 18 months. It's incredible. That's a company we're often compared to. But restaurants are realizing they can't survive, right, without on one channel. They have to have takeout delivery. They have to have catering. They have to have all of these various channels to serve their customers where and when they need to be served. And they need technology to enable that, right? And so one thing we offer is an integrated online ordering solution when that plugs right into the kitchen. So you order, you know, on a restaurant's website or on an app, and it goes right into the kitchen, right? And when it's completed, you're notified, and it's a very seamless end-to-end experience, fully integrated. And that's really attractive to folks who are adopting that channel for the very first time. So I think the acceleration is continuing because restaurants realize they can't, you know, for them to operate in today's environment, they need to have a diverse set of channels to meet their customers. We're also starting to see not just takeout and delivery, but what we call digital dine-in begin to emerge, which is, if you've ever, you'll know it when you see it, if you've ever had to wait for your check, right, while at a restaurant, you're just kind of waiting for the server to bring it back, but they're busy. They've got a number of tables and they've got other customers to see. There are new technologies now where you can, you know, scan a QR code and pay your bill on your phone when you want and just leave, right? Which is better for the restaurant because it allows them to turn the table faster, which improves their yield. And it's a better experience for the customer because they don't have to wait. And so you're starting to see more and more of this permeate restaurant operations, which ultimately is great for restaurant operators. So I think it was COVID and the pandemic and the regulation on, you know, having people in your store was a great forcing function for restaurants to begin to leverage technology in ways that larger brands, right, had already done. So, which has been great for our business because we offer a great suite of products that allow, make it easier to do all of those things, right? And, you know, we're going to invest more in R&D than anyone in our space. Well, I think we said we'll invest $1 billion over the next 5 years in R&D, which is far more than anyone else, all in the spirit of, furthering our mission of helping restaurants, you know, thrive and do what they love.
And when you think of restaurants, I think sometimes from the technology end of things, it can sometimes seem a little old fashioned. You know, you think about paper tickets, or like, I'm trying to think back on the restaurants that I've worked at. Did you encounter, as you were getting into some of this, like maybe some of this more conservative mindset, or did COVID and everything just like push it in this direction that people, it's a very easy sell at this point?
It's never an easy sell. Sales folks will tell you that, right? It's certainly more competitive, right? And so when you see companies like Toast raising a lot of money, right, it becomes, and a lot of capital flowing to restaurant technology, which there has been over the last 4 or 5 years, it becomes much more competitive. So we're not the only ones out there. And that I think, you know, we love to compete. And so, I think restaurants are now eager, really for the first time, to learn and adapt and leverage technology to make their lives easier. I'll give you an example of that. So we recently acquired a payroll company a couple years ago called Stratix. We now offer an integrated payroll solution. So when you talk to restaurants about running payroll, they'll tell you, oh, well, Monday is my payroll day. That's when I set aside the entire day to like run payroll, because they have to take all the data from the point of sale, which includes the wages, the hours worked by job type, the tips, everything, and they have to somehow get it into their payroll system, and they're not connected. And we acquired a payroll business and integrated it into our point of sale. And so now to run payroll, you push a button. Okay. And so it saves an incredible amount of time for restaurants who would ordinarily spend an entire day running payroll. Now it takes, you know, just a matter of, you know, a few clicks. And so there are a lot of ways we can help restaurants in that sense of the point of sale is the main artery, the main hub of the restaurant, but there are all of these other elements that plug in to make their lives easier. You've probably worked in a restaurant. I remember I worked in a restaurant. 70% of our team has worked in a restaurant. The process of calculating tips at the end of the night is like a crazy one, right? We've got spreadsheets and like formulas, and you're trying to allocate to the busboy and to the server and to the bartender. It's crazy, right? It's manual. We had now a feature where you push a button. It's all done for you. So it's really a great example. There are many, many examples like this of us leveraging technology to automate workflows and processes that ultimately save restaurants and restaurateurs a lot of time and a lot of money. That's a big part of our growth story.
And I would imagine, since many restaurants are small businesses, you know, maybe they have a few stores, but many of them may just be one store. It's hard for them to make these kind of technology investments on their own and be very capital intensive, very expensive.
Yeah, I think because we're all, you know, we've an integrated payments solution with our product, you know, we're able to offer really unique and creative financing opportunities for restaurants, right? And so there are ways where we can eliminate all of the upfront costs, as an example, and amortize it over time. We are lending to restaurants. We have a loan program where we'll lend to restaurants for expansion, for the new fridge that they may need, to build a new patio, to whatever it might be, to grow their footprint, you know, because we are involved in their payments and their credit card processing. You know, we can underwrite, you know, loans to them in a really, really healthy way, which helps them access capital. And it helps a market like restaurants whose access to capital has been very limited, right? And it's opened it up and allowed them to grow. So, you know, the story of how we help restaurants may have started with the point of sale, which is the main artery, but it will really be written by all the different ways in which we can help them, whether it's lending, whether it's payroll, whether it's, you know, helping them digitize their offerings, you know, email marketing, digital things as simple as digital gift cards, right? So, you know, we're investing quite a bit to help make things really, really easy and efficient for them.
How has your Darden experience been helpful to you, Jonathan, as you've gone through all of this? You know, you work at Toast. Do you still pull on some of the learning from that time?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I spend most of my time thinking through, certainly the people leadership aspect is a significant component. We've got a large team. And so understanding how we've defined the value proposition for our team, defined and delivering the value proposition for our team is a significant component of what we do. We do a lot of modeling, right? And trying to understand, you know what do we need to achieve certain goals, or how will things happen? It often starts in a spreadsheet. And so a lot of the modeling skills that I learned at Darden have really helped. One of the early things that we did that I learned in decision in a DA class, which was hard for me, right, was distribution of data. And one of the first things we looked at when we joined Toast was looking at the distribution of our team's performance. And it was, you know, what we found was it looked a lot like an 80-20 or Pareto, where a small percentage of the team was really carrying most of the performance. And so we set a goal to flatten that out, right? And we really focused on having a more balanced distribution of performance across our large sales force. And that led to a number of, you know, changes to our comp plans, to how we thought about resourcing, enablement, different things. And today it's flipped. Like, we have a really strong distribution of performance. But that would not have been a thing that I would have thought of, right, pre-Darden. It was something I learned in DA and started to think, well, how can I use, and that's the value of the executive program. Like, you're working, okay, while you're in school. And so you'd sit in these classes and think about, how could I relate this to what I'm doing right now, which was such an advantage, right, to actually take something that you're learning in a academic setting and apply it to the real world, like the next day. Okay. And so that really helped me. And but there are things like that that I pull on every day that I still have all of my old cases printed, and I refer back to them when I'm thinking through a challenge or a problem. So it's certainly the gift that keeps on giving.
All right. Well, we ask everybody the same last question here on the podcast. Any piece of advice for our listeners, for the people tuning in here? It could be Darden specific, it could be NBA specific, or just, you know, business advice, something that you found useful.
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, as you're thinking about your career, right, and where you want to grow to, you need to have a framework that helps you with your decision making to understand what's important. All right. And so, you know, for me, I had kind of developed this framework because I'd always been in high growth businesses where we were growing rapidly, right? Which means if you're growing rapidly, you're adding headcount rapidly, right? Which means there's more opportunity, and that opportunity comes faster, right? And so that experience shaped like what my next opportunity would look, you know, the odds of finding me at a slow or a lower growth business are just zero. Right. And so, cause I have this framework in my mind of always going to be in a high growth business. First of all, it fits my personality, which is kind of fast paced and impatient. Right. But I'm always gonna be in a high growth business, and I'm going to go after, you know, work with companies who are addressing a large and significant market with some competitive advantage that is unique, right? And that framework is not all that different from the way that VCs are, you know, how they think about making decisions. But you really have to spend time thinking about, you know, what really matters to you in your career, and what variables are critical or are inputs to get you there. That may be a little abstract, but hopefully that's helpful to someone.
Well, it resonates with how we talk about the MBA process for sure. I mean, if you think about, you know, how you think about a program, well, what's important to you? You know, and how do you sort of reflect upon, you know, your values, the expression of those values in the institution, or the kind of people you want to learn with, the way you're going to be engaged with as a student in the classroom, outside of the classroom. I mean, very easily analogize that to the career search and trying to find your next opportunity. Well, what are you looking forward to with Toast? It sounds like things are perhaps busier than they ever have been.
They really are. We were just commenting on that earlier today. It seems like we have a lot happening. If you read the S1, if you read, you know, the things we've said about our business, we have only captured a very small percentage of our TAM, and we think, you know, we have the opportunity to build a very, very unique business. And so it's not losing to Finland. That's what we're focused on, right? And delivering upon what we've already built and helping folks grow their careers within our company and reach goals that maybe they didn't think they could reach, and delivering a ton of value for our customer. That's what we're really focused on.
Jonathan, I know how much you have on your plate, very busy person. Thank you so much for taking time out for the podcast. It's so great to catch up with you, to hear about all the great things that are happening at Toast. Thrilled for you when you sent me the photo. Thank you so much for sharing the good news with us, and for coming on the podcast and sharing your story with our listeners.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Hopefully this was helpful, and I'll look forward to connecting with you all soon.
And that was my interview with Jonathan Bassel, member of our Executive MBA class of 2018. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's EXEC, MBA, at darden.virginia.edu. Until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.